This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
They'll find you. And again, if anyone has anything they want to hand in, they can do it either at those quiet sessions or else can leave them with me after the meeting this morning.
Something I forgot to mention before, in the library, in the card catalog, listing under English 410, there is a bibliography made up. And so there are a bunch of books on reserve there if you want to look them over. There's a smart paper reading, also some odd books that we may have run into or may not have. So it's under English 410 in the card catalog. And there are some books on reserve there.
Yeah. They, Alan, does that, do that, that includes Louise, doesn't it? Louise Karski?
No,
doesn't. Someone asked me after the last meeting if we could make a bibliography of his work.
We should have perhaps assembled a bibliography.
Well, Arnold, we were thinking about the whole issue of reading lists and the fact that now that, as Charles was saying, that there are so many paperbacks in print and such a range of material, that the issue of a reading list can become an oversimplification. In other words, I haven't thought of it that way, and yet it makes great sense to me. The books that will have literal particular value for you will be in large part those books which you find. In other words, I remember Ed Dalberg gave me a reading list and I lost it the very first day. Then had this awfully awkward time trying to remember what was on it and read as much as I could of that in order to continue conversation. But in other words, it would be much more interesting if you, in effect, make your own centers of this order. This is not a question of simple information. For example, as the man who asked me last time about Lou Zukofsky, I see no reason why I shouldn't have a complete list of Zukofsky's books. But I don't. I begin to wonder what the whole issue of recommendation can do. Because if you get a book when you're not interested in it, that's of no use to you, really. And you know what reading lists are from, say, formal course structure. You may or may not have interesting reading lists offered to you then and there. No. So this morning, Well, what should we do? We were thinking of reading some things that were particular. Not prepared.
In that hard thing, though.
Yeah. Let me read one or two of Hart Crane's poems, because again, I'm thinking this whole issue of reading this. In the 40s, the early 40s, I remember Hart Crane was not really used in any of the courses that I took. He would be referred to, but he would be could usually be left out because of the assumption at that time that his bridge was a technical failure, and therefore there was no real reason to be interested in his writing.
So wasn't this a view that his friends had? That this is coming, you know, actually, Hart Crane's immediate friends and the Tates and Waldo Frank, who presented him, all of them presumed since he was lived a disordered life that he had a disordered poetic, and so they gave a picture that there was something splendid in it. This is a bunch of very draft ducks indeed who were looking at something that did have a splendor in it, and that it was, but that you couldn't learn anything from it, or that he was just mixed up as a poet, which is anything would look mixed up to Alan Page.
At Melville's tomb, often beneath the wave, wide from this ledge, the dice of drowned men's bones he saw bequeath an embassy, their numbers as he watched beat on the dusty shore and were obscured, and wrecks passed without sound of bells, the calyx of death's bounty giving back a scattered chapter, livid hieroglyph, the portent wound in carvers of shells. Then in the circuit calm of one vast coil, its lashings charmed and malice reconciled, frosted eyes there were that lifted altars, and silent answers crept across the stars. compass, quadrant, and sextant contrive no farther tides. High in the azure steeps, Monades shall not wake the mariner. This fabulous shadow only the sea keeps. It's amazing to think of that.
It's a beautiful voice.
Yeah. Isn't that, this is what I mean about reading lists. In other words, unless you trust your own senses, you'll be told that that's of no interest. And I don't see how that's to be dealt with except by your own energies or your own little concerns and abilities. Otherwise, you see, you can never rely on other opinion to that extent. I hope. Yeah.
This is a poem that when I was discovered at 18 or 19, but then of course all the rest of my life has been some sort of core. Above the fresh ruffles of the surf, bright striped urchins play each other with sand. They have contrived a conquest for shell shucks, and their fingers crumble fragments of baked weed, gaily digging and scattering. And in answer to their treble interjections, the sun beats lightning on the waves. The waves fold thunder on the sand. And could they hear me, I would tell them. Oh, brilliant kids, frisk with your dog, fondle your shells and sticks, bleached by time and the elements. But there is a line you must not cross, nor ever trust beyond it, spry cordage of your bodies to caresses, too light and faithful from too wide a breadth. The bottom of the sea is cruel. Now, when I read it at 18 or 19, I thought it referred to some sexual submission or surrender, that line. But there is a line you must not cross, nor ever trust beyond it, bright cordage of your body's two caresses. But here I talked about when we were naming the peril, and Creeley said it was breaking a phase or something, and Alan said it was giving a wrong message that would not be wrong. For me, it was really the same line. It was a boundary that I thought was perilous, and had something to do with the boundary of my knowing or of my being. And so, of course, that still then is the sexual first thing that line meant to me, the sexual thing. But it's also now being and consciousness has. But there is a line you must not cross, nor ever trust beyond it, bright cordage of your body's two caresses. But it, of course, to even say something like that opens up and invites crossing. But knowing, and in some kind of aesthetic, then knowing at the line the mistrust. I mean, so that the mistrust becomes, that's what this poem seems to me now lifts. Not fear, but really a savoring of the line, so that it contains. I must not, just when you have to cross, have no other things that you can do, and also, I will never trust beyond it, but I have to live then on what I cannot trust. That was part of what I meant. That's what I thought the peril was, and it still is a peril for me, and some little link at least went to Hart Crane, and I knew I was in some way like Hart Crane, although I certainly liked and feel that I was not. That's the first of the voyages. There are five voyages. I think also in Hart Crane, the way the bridge was built itself, this large poem built of sections, and they were interrelated, and very, in the terms of most people who want to cement things in, as if a poem were a bridge or a chair, and you actually sat on it, and it might collapse. It was airy. I mean, it opened up propositions. The way you could move from the bridge from one poem to another and have this a world opening was an invitation. It did excite the idea of poems being related this way as voyages too. A sequence
of poems
that then opened up the possibility that whatever was in a group of poems would interrelate without you pressing.
That's all right.
Did everybody here read Atlantis?
Yeah.
It had an epic graph before, it was a of that which relates to love in harmony and system. Through the bound cable strand, the arching path upward, veering with light, the flight of string, taut miles of shuffling moonlight, syncopate the whispered rush, telepathy of wire, up the index of night, granite and steel, transparent meshes, fleckless, the gleaming stage, sibylline voices flicker, waveringly stream, as though a god were issue of the string, and through that portage, threading with its call, one arc, synoptic of all tides below, their labyrinthine mouths of history pouring reply, as though all ships at sea complied in one vibrant breath, made cry, make thy love sure, to we whose soul we fly. From black embankments, moveless sounding hails, so seven oceans answer from their dreams. And on, obliquely up bright carrier bars, new octaves trestle the twin monoliths beyond whose frosted capes the moon bequeaths two worlds of sleep, O arching strand of soul. Onward and up the crystal-flooded aisle, white tempest nets file upward, upward ring with silver terraces the humming spars, the loft of vision, palladium helm of stars. Sheerly the eyes, like seagulls stung with rime, slit and propelled by glistening fins of light, kick biting way up towering looms that press sidelong with flight of blade on pendant blade, tomorrow's into yesteryear, and link what cipher script of time no traveler reads, but who, through smoking pyres of love and death, searches the timeless laugh of mythic spheres, like hails, farewells, up planet sequin heights, some trillion whispering hammers glimmer higher, serenely, sharply up the long anvil cry of inchling eons, silence rivets Troy. And you, aloft there, Jason, Hestine, shout, still wrapping harness to the swarming air, silvery the rushing wake, surpassing call, beams yelling Aeolus, splintered in the straits, from gulfs enfolding, terrible of drums, tall vision of the voyage, tensely spare, bridge lifting night to cycloramic crest of deepest day, O choir translating time into what multitudinous verb the suns and synergy of waters ever fuse, recast in myriad syllables, psalm of Cathay, O love, thy white pervasive paradigm. We left the haven hanging in the night. Sheened harbor lanterns backward fled the keel. Pacific pier at time's end, bearing corn. Eyes stammer through the pangs of dust and steel, and still the circular, indubitable freeze of heaven's meditation, yoking wave to kneeling wave, one song devoutly binds, the vernal stroke chimes from deathless string. O thou steel cognizance whose leap commits the agile precincts of the lark's return, within whose lariat sweep and cinctured sing in single chrysalis the many twain, of stars thou art the stitch and stallion glow, and like an organ thou with sound of doom, sight, sound, and flesh thou leadest from time's realm, as love strikes clear direction for the helm. Swift peal of secular light, intrinsic myth, whose cell unshadowed is death's utter womb. O river-throated, iridescently upborn through the bright drench and fabric of our veins, with white escarpments swinging into light, sustained in tears, the cities are endowed and justified, conclaimant with ripe fields revolving through their harvests in sweet torment. Forever deity's glittering pledge, O thou whose canticle fresh chemistry assigns to rapt inception and beatitude,
always through blinding cables to our joy of thy white seizure springs the prophecy. Always through spiring cordage, pyramids of silver sequel, deity's young name, kinetic of white fiery wings, ascends, migrations that must needs void memory, inventions that cobblestone the heart, unspeakable thou bridge to thee, O love, thy pardon for this history, whitest flower, O answerer of all. Anemone, now while thy petals spend the suns about us hold, O thou whose radiance doth inherit me, Atlantis, hold thy floating singer late. So to thine ever-presence beyond time, like spears and sanguine of one tolling star that leads infinity, the Orphic strings, sidereal phalanxes leap and converge, one song, one bridge of fire, is it Cathay? Now Phinny steeps the grass, and rainbows bring the serpent with the eagle in the leaves, whispers antiphonal in azure swing.
What's the date on this? 1930? About 26?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure of the, as far as the date goes. I'm trying to remember that I know there was another word how a word can come to you that because you have and you've never had it in your vocabulary before. Diapasons was one that came, and then came right out of Crane, so it sounded drowned when in the medieval scenes came diapasons of a drowned magnificence. And actually that line in some way refers to Crane and the business of his being drowned. But I can't remember now the poem where the diapasons were. Sometimes a word, and Crane actually used words as if they were plastic coloring. Would find himself in a very awkward position indeed when he had to account for them, but what's most interesting is that he then did try to account for every word, did try to say this is here because for all of those mounting arabesques
sometimes I've found that a single word can be the only clue to a poem that one is carrying around for months. All one has is one word, and it's charged with something that you haven't yet been able to release. It's as if you eventually had to find a pin and prick that word, and then the rest of the poem comes out right out of it through the pinhole.
This is the second of voyages where Alan remembered where the diapason was. And yet this great wink of eternity, of rimless floods, unfettered leewarding, Samite sheeted and processional. Let me start again. And yet this great wink of eternity, of rimless floods, unfettered leewarding, Samite cheated in procession, where her undernal vast belly moonward bends, laughing the rapt inflections of our love. Take this sea whose diapason knells on scrolls of silver snowy sentences, the scepter terror of whose session rends, as her demeanor's motion well or ill, all but the pieties of lover's hands. And onward, as bells off San Salvador salute the crocus lustres of the stars, those poinsettias meadows of her tides, adagios of islands, O my prodigal, complete with dark confessions her veins fell. Mark how her turning shoulders wind the hours, and hasten while her penniless rich palms pass superscription of bent foam and wave. Hasten while they are true, sleep, death, desire, close round one instant in one floating flower. Bind us in time, O seasons clear and awe, O minstrel galleons of Carapia, bequeath us to no earthly shore until is answered in the vortex of our grave the seal's wide spindrift gaze toward paradise. That's another one of those inviting words, spindrift. In both of those, diapason and spindrift, we really have gotten to the word itself has a numinous, talk about numen, it has a numinous, has an aura so that we aren't concerned with meaning. When we pick it apart and find a meaning, we've lost the like looking at a living cell and trying. So far, the great complaint in science is they haven't been able both to look and have the cell living, and so of course they have to have it without that aura. But those words have aura that goes.
But also, have a great meaning.
Oh yes, the straightening. But by the way, what if you had all those? What if you had just a crowd of auras? There's nothing more mixed up in a poem than the person who goes, gee, if I had the, like, well, Crane, he only had these. These, maybe if I had 50 of them in two lines of big words.
I was thinking that this is suicide.
This is the second of the voyages.
I was thinking that this is suicide complicated. Because you are no earthly shore until it answers the importance of the world.
I think I would relate it to that, but I think we might understand what he was doing when he leapt in the water. We're all misled about the business of suicide because we aren't supposed to do it in, as far as the general legalistic structure. But if you only have to pose somebody in other civilizations to realize there are a multitude of reasons and meanings in saying it's called committing suicide. If you believe in reincarnation, you may kill yourself in order not to do something the next moment, and it would not have the significance it has as an act against God within a Christian or Judaic religion. You wouldn't be shortening your days since you've got them no matter what. You can imagine a person throwing themselves, I always, as a child, could imagine throwing yourself in the waves or in fire in pure ecstasy of elemental dissolve. As a matter of fact, one of the problems, one of the struggles emotionally, I remember particularly when I was at a time when I was about 10 or 11, sitting by a mountain stream and saying, how can I have so completely a feeling of this stream and not be in it, not be entirely it. And I could imagine as an undine throwing yourself into the stream.
Well, that's how I'm saying, and that thing in the museum is going to be the ladle. It's the same.
Yeah, so
you want to be
in that sense, it is a picture of suicide. We can almost imagine that in that drunken kid, and especially when they played them. When they had that interview of people who knew Crane and were talking about him, that woman that he was going back with and even might have been to marry, her account of it was, well, I had a headache in my cabin. He didn't really pay any attention to me. This hard voice him. And he was always thoughtless. And if he'd really known how I felt, and it was like him to jump off the boat. I had to account for it in the morning. Yeah, so that there was a combination. Wouldn't you want to go out on that spindrift of paradise? It certainly wasn't on the boat.
A hurricane. Lord, thou ridest. Lord, thy swifting heart naught stayeth, naught now biteth, but smithereened apart. I, scripture, fleeth stone. Milk bright thy chisel wind rescindeth flesh from bone to quivering, whittling thin. Swept, whistling straw, battered, lordine boulders now outleap, rock sockets, leaven lathered, nor lord may worm out deep thy drum gum bad it plunge abscond, lord god wild summits crashing, with sea kelp screaming on blonde sky seas, high heaven dashing, thou ridest to the door, Lord, thou bidest wall nor floor, Lord.
Yeah. There's a
That was
sort of
rocking it up.
Yeah. There's apparently I knew a good friend of Crane, Slater Brown, who told me that he was terrified of hurricanes. They were they really frightened him. And he was staying at Brown's house in New York at one time. They'd gone out for something. There was this one, the summer thunderstorms, and came back to find the woman who did the cleaning for them, and Crane were both under the bed.
Yes.
The storm is raging. They're holding on to each other. Both. Both of them. So this, yeah, this.
Well, Pound was very impressed that when the Joyces came to visit, there was a thunderstorm, and Rapallo and Joyce wouldn't come out from under the bed all day. It had been washed, and he was still
there. Yeah.
Still there. And Nora said, "Well, you should. He has to wait till the sun has really gone away before he'll come out."
The thing I think is great about all is that almost all his major poems have a kind of organic rhythm that begins and builds almost like a tune.
Yeah.
Atlantic does, he knows that almost the first thing he's doing. Also, and he has this great length of eternity, also has a great thing.
This one, I think. This
I think it's like in Shelley. Very similar to Shelley goes into the room with a sense of passion, then he begins and sort of finding that whole answer.
Yes, really open.
All this tension that has been building up suddenly becomes aware of what the object was. In one way or another.
We were talking about this last night in the sense of, apropos of my own poems, where at one point the logic of the poem tended to ride beyond the possibility at some point at the end of certain poems that I was then writing, where I found that the form had given me an instruction or a direction that became demanding, or became a question in the whole feeling, in terms of the feeling. Whereas, I think one, for example, that I've always loved was this, The Broken Tower, which is written after the whole the sequence of the bridge and all. It was at a time, apparently, when he was on the ropes, as we were talking about this difficulty. And again, Slater Brown told me that he got this, that Crane sent him this poem with a question as to whether or not it was any good, literally, if it showed anything possible. And the way all of us are, apparently, I think that Slater was one of his few deeply sympathetic friends.
This was clear in that group, yeah. In that interview. Yeah. He was one of the... It's about the only person around Crane to imagine this man with friends who
That's
were really
friend,
antagonistic to everything he was in the
yeah.
poem or
Tate,
in his person.
It's extraordinary.
This is a series of interviews of all the people that had known Crane, and they're describing the month. You know, he went back to New York and then went back. It's a tape built up.
The Pacifica Station
State.
And they went to all these people.
They did one on show with
them.
Anderson. They've done several like that.
Well,
I know in the letters, for example, if you read his letters, you find that the time when he's up in upstate New York working on the bridge, and these incredible arguments that occur between Alan Tate and himself.
Oh,
Alan Tate's feelings are hurt, and he leaves, and how difficult a man this is to live with, and so on.
Well, and then one poet, Ivor Winters, was so frightened by the homosexuality that he actually changed his entire direction in poetics. You have only to look at early issues of Hound and Horn and find Ivor Winters writing an open poetics. He felt that an open poetics in and of itself led to the dissolution and suicide which Ivor Winters predicted in a letter to Crane, so that in another twist, Ivor Winters is almost pushing there. He says, if you go on, this is an untenable way to write poetry, and because of that, you have an untenable life, and you will come to the place where you yourself will see that if you cannot possibly go on. So that the minute Crane couldn't go on in poetry, too, he thought he'd come to that place. This we do know.
Yeah.
He was really quite frightened when he came to a period when the poetry would not come to him. Then he felt, yes, now you should see that Ivor Winters was right, that the poetics was untenable because I can't write poems.
But the other thing is, if he had been afraid to the occupation of this particular point of living,
that's what he was trying to
say. Had he really broken that, then he would have been willing to write poems yeah. other parts of his consciousness and it might have saved him.
Again, I was thinking, apropos my own. I think Crane was one of the, he was about the first poet that I could hear rhythms in distinctly, that I could locate as terms of feeling. And, yeah. The bell rope that gathers guard at dawn dispatches me as though I dropped down the knell of the spent day, to wander the cathedral lawn from pit to crucifix, feet chill on steps from hell. Have you not heard, have you not seen that core of shadows in the tower, whose shoulders sway antiphonal carillons, launched before the stars are caught and hived in the sun's ray? The bells, I say, the bells break down their tower and swing I know not where, their tongues engraved membrane through marrow my bomb-scattered score of broken intervals, and I, their sexton slave. Oval and cyclicals and canyons heaping the impasse high with choir, bank voices slaying pagodas, campaniles with river leaves outleaping, oak terraced echoes prostrate on the plain. And so it was I entered the broken world, to trace the visionary company of love, its voice, an instant in the wind, I know not whither hurled, but not for long to hold each desperate choice. My word I poured, but was it cognate score to that tribunal monarch of the air, whose thigh and bronze is earth, strife's crystal word, in wounds pledged once to hope, cleft to despair? The steep encroachments of my blood left me no answer. Could blood hold such a lofty tower as flings the question true? Or is it she whose sweet mortality stirs latent power, and through whose pulse I hear, counting the strokes my veins recall and add, revived and sure, the angelus of wars my chest evokes, what I hold healed, original now, and pure, and builds within a tower that is not stone. Not stone can jacket heaven, but slip of pebbles, visible wings of silence sown, and azure circles widening as they dip, the matrix of the heart, flip down the... let me start this again. And builds within a tower that is not stone. Not stone can jacket heaven, but slip of pebbles, visible wings of silence sown, in azure circles widening as they dip, the matrix of the heart, lift down the eye that shrines the quiet lake and swells the tower. The commodious tall decorum of that sky unseals her earth and lifts love in its shell.
One thing in San Francisco, following Crane and also the influence of Lorca, a group of poets arose who called themselves activists. They meant that every word was active in the poem. And they did a thing that was very inviting, but also was not opening. When you hear this poem, Cranes, you're aware that it really does have the ringing bells in the ear. Mm-hmm. But the bells and the bell tones were so inviting that these poets took over as decorative elements words like from Crane, like bell or carillon, and they became adjectives instead of nouns of things heard, but even Crane's adjectives of things heard, and began to be a pure configuration, but even then not even waiting to hear them or have them happen, so that you've got a decorative poetry that had lost the initial source of energy, which is really outside the poem, the fact that Crane is always hearing and always attendant by these things that are entering the poem. And now, by praying, it was the sound of words and these things, and it had only the charge that they could get from, only the charge that they could get from the Crane poem. Finally, actually, this became a very mannered school of poetry, whose poems had a great deal of beauty and confidence in making of a poem. So that it was only in the summation that you found nothing. There was no other thing that would come in via the poems, or curious attitudes, or collectors.
Yeah.
You could collect words out. You could collect words out of Crane. You could collect these bell things and have them reoccurred. Yeah. But the thing they did not do, they were not interested in rising on a rhythm that was, because that would have opened up their own language. You can't rise on a rhythm in someone else's language. For instance, Alan is made very clear that Crane was a source. And when you read Crane, you see very much that it was the way you read Crane and the rise that gives you, but then there's only one way to rise, and that is in your own language, in the one that will provide that root for you.
I was remembering at the time that I was becoming, you know, literally conscious of this possibility in college, all the attitude then present was to continue with the description, as though a poem were literally a mere description of some activity. In other words, use this activity in the sense that Robert outlines here as an occasion for ornament. You ornament the activity as though. And then, of course, when Crane was read in that in respect, he became a collection of oddities or extensions of language in this way, so that his language was always assumed to be decorative, which I frankly never felt. And again, coming from that New England closeness of speech, he was a revelation to me that the impulse could stay just as true, in fact, even had more room when the language was allowed to move with it, as opposed to, as against, let's say, a constant withdrawal from the impulse in the language.
One thing he shows that you to trust going that beyond, crossing beyond, yeah, beyond anything you can consciously control, let that language fling out that way is where something happens. He does show you that it can be that can happen. Just the thing that his friend felt was most dangerous is the place
where he is most safe.
Where actually safety. If you can fly that way, then we're in the place where we wrote that other alternative. There is no peril anywhere. Is the trust of the only real trust is the trust with which you throw yourself into the abyss, or into any element.
Well, he's trusting his own impulse rhythm.
Yes, he's trusting his own
emotions.
What's making a way?
Even though he's talking about
whatever
transcendental state, he's pouring all his physical love into it.
Well, one thing that interests me about now that we've taken hold of Crane is if we move back to the time when this bridge was written, one of the puzzling things in our own time is what is a contemporary and how do we feel about contemporaries? And sometimes we wonder, how is it that there are oppositions? There were extreme oppositions at the time of Crane. Now, why was Crane surrounded by that group of people, and why, for instance, why wasn't William Carlos Williams saying you're doing fine work? Well, he wasn't saying you're doing fine work because William Carlos Williams was really he thought of this bridge as a possible rival, and he wrote jocularly about it as a rival, but he put it down very definitely. He said, well, some people like Tate and Waldo Frank think this fellow Crane, who's writing this bridge thing, is a real thing now, he says, writing along about 1930. Already Williams was in a kind of in a period when the big thing of spring and all had deserted him, and he was in the beginning feeling the low tide in the spirit, feel the low tide, and certainly feel Williams had himself very few readers, very few people who would come and tell him that the poem was there. He had fewer than Crane, who had surrounded with people who were telling him he was wrong, but were always excited when he was reading. Now Crane himself was just puzzled by Pound or Williams. He couldn't figure out at all what they were doing. But in the recent cantos of Pound says in one line, "How could I ever have had peace of soul when my friends hated each other?" Now, the two of the friends that hated each other were Wyndham Lewis and Joyce, and two of the friends that hated each other were T.S. Eliot and Williams, so violently that a split occurred with Pound straddling in the middle of the split, having to say absolutely Williams and absolutely Eliot. He was much more impressed with Eliot because Eliot had Pound, who was not only a poet, but he wanted to be a professor. And he wanted to lecture, but I suspect that possibly Pound lectures were as confused as our efforts. So he's terrifically impressed by Eliot. He could get up and deliver a very convincing argument for almost anything. I mean, he could sell you right there, and it would have a beginning and a middle and an end, like Eliot is always telling himself, beginning, middle, and end. And there it was. And Pound said, how in the world does he have a... whereas he did realize, he said, that Bill Williams over there, he's got a brain. He doesn't have a beginning, a middle, and end.